Hello, you have reached the planet of Don't Believe Jack. Today is October 5th. Happy Halloween, everybody. Hopefully we'll do another episode before Halloween. Welcome to the show. Stuff is going on in the world. A lot of people are angry about it. I know. A lot of people really upset, been watching the news. Really angry. They're really angry that Real Madrid beat Tottenham. They're really angry about that. And I am too. I want you to know that I think it's outrageous. And I don't think that in 2018, Real Madrid should be able to just roll any team in the English Premier League. No, of course not. That's not actually what's going on. Everyone is really, really upset about the Kavanaugh thing. I wanted to talk about it. I do want to say from the top that I don't think... I do want to say Tottenham first. Tottenham. I don't know if they actually talk like that in Tottenham, but I hope they do, because that, I feel like that's a killer... That's a killer accent. Tottenham. I'm from Tottenham. I like how, like, with English English teams, the way that English people talk, you can't. It's sort of like you hear, you hear that high class British accent, like received pronunciation, as it's called, and you're like, yes, oh wow, they're so smart, and then you hear like every other British accent, and you're like, oh yeah, no, there's a reason we broke up. As an American, you hear that. I didn't really like the idea of spending the holidays with that voice. Tottenham. I do want to be an Englishman so badly. An Englishman. I'm not even sure. They have so many accents. It's crazy. I mean, like, America has a lot of accents, right? Like, I mean, I get that. But, like, British people, I mean, even in the city of my old roommates explained to me when they lived in the city of London that there were so many accents. Accents would almost be, like, neighborhood by neighborhood. And we're talking, like, small neighborhoods. So it's not even, like, in other words, you'd have a different accent if you lived six blocks away from somebody back in the day in London. That's how... Like, even though it was, like, London, it was just a collection of a bunch of small cities. It's sort of like L.A., how L.A. actually is, like, there's some cities with, like, a bunch of history. You know, there's Culver City, or there's this city. I have family members who live in Newton, and Newton was its own city, separate from Boston. You know, there are a lot of churches and religious community in Newton. I think that's, like, so, you know, that we have these giant cities, but we have these small cities within them with their own, like, little history and their own funky accents and ways of being. Even though they're only, like, a couple miles away from one another. But admittedly, like, I don't know, in 1800, getting from Newton to Boston was probably, like, I don't know, it probably took, like, 3 days, you know? Like, you'd kiss your wife and you'd say, if I... like, you miss your kids growing up just going into town. It's just so far. They had carriages. People rode in carriages and on horses. That's crazy. You can't get around that way. It's so slow. Oh, also, when you show up, where are you going to park? You got to have a place for your mode of transportation to poop and get adequate water. I guess people just, like, walked places. You would just walk? There wasn't any kind of, like, bus system. I mean, I don't know. Are there, like, tokens? Are there people sleeping on these buses? It's amazing to think. I don't know. And especially, like, that's crazy that they had to do that much walking and they wore the weirdest looking shoes and pantaloons. Like, I feel like our clothing, I wonder if that clothing was comfortable. It doesn't look comfortable at all. Like, if you look at the way a guy dresses in revolutionary America, it looks just extremely uncomfortable. I don't know. I think you spent most of your time just itching, is what it seems like to me. Also, you couldn't show any skin, you know. And I have nice legs, so that would have been real hard. it's like, it's like, oh, I don't want to go back to friggin' 1776. I got nice legs. I also have black skin. That'd be another reason why I probably wouldn't want to go back to 1776. That'd be reason number two. But number one is I got nice legs and I want to show them off. You know, I put a lot of work into these calves. And people have a right to know how nice my calves are. My brother makes fun of me for having hair on my legs. He thinks I'm a weirdo. I'm the outcast in the family. I'm like, look, mom has more hair on her legs. No, that's not true. That's not true. That's a damn lie. anyways, this is another episode of Don't Believe Jack. So going from the 1776 to 2018, our world is, quote unquote, on fire. A lot of people are upset. I mean, you know, people are still taking, like, it's funny because to go back, if you listen to the book report episode, this might be about the 10 reasons to delete your social media account. I think this might actually be the moment when stuff actually becomes, like, when Instagram becomes negative. Because I've noticed for the first time people are putting anti-Kavanaugh stuff on Instagram. Whereas Instagram used to be all, like, positivity, now people are putting anti-Kavanaugh posts and calling him an asshole and a douchebag and all these other words. And it's getting more like the tone is now getting negative. So I'm wondering if Jerron Lanier is right, that because basically his theory, in, you know, if you listen to that episode, is that social media program, like, you know, platforms always start out super positive, and then over time they become more negative as, you know, people's rhetoric gets nastier and it becomes more about attention seeking. And I wonder if that's going to happen. Because Instagram, for the most part, has avoided being political, in my mind. I mean, mostly it's just, like, cat pictures. I call it Instabutt, because it's mostly just workout. It's a lot of, like, you know, fitness people. And it's comedy. And Instabutt, if that's not comedy, I don't know what is. I don't want to... If that's not comedy, I don't want to do comedy. I'm a man of principles, okay? I'm wearing a powdered wig right now and pantaloons. I'm somewhere in Western Massachusetts. I'm writing with a quill pen. This podcast is being recorded on a music box. I have a man named Jeffrey bringing me tea. But in any case, on that digression, yeah, I mean, Instagram is now getting, it's like people are posting negative stuff on there. And it is interesting. I wonder if, like, now that the switch has been flipped, it's almost like, you know, the, how can I put it? The dam has broken. You know, they've broken the seal, as we used to say in college. You can't break the seal. Once you start, you know, I don't know, for all of you listening and from other countries, right, you can't break the seal. That means it's the very enlightened idea that college students discovered and discover every year that, that when you drink, the moment you start peeing, you have to keep peeing. But if you never pee, you'll pee all over yourself at night when you go to sleep. You know, you'll wake up in the morning covered in piss. So don't break the seal is the message, piss your bed. And they figured this out every year. It's like a big discovery. I feel like there should be a bunch of frat boys who are trying to get published in, like, Science or Nature, like, every year. Just like, oh, we've done this, like, this empirical study about seal breakage. I wonder if there is actually science to it. I personally think the breaking the seal thing is a myth, but it's a fun myth passed down from generation to generation of young men and women. It's one of the things that keeps us all connected with one another, even if it's a lie, like democracy. Which brings me to my subject, the Kavanaugh hearings. Everyone is super upset about it. I want to say at the top, I have a lot of thoughts about this, and none of them are about whether he did it or not. I feel like I'm just going to say at the top because I don't really know, who's responsible for what, but I can more talk about, you know, how people, I'm more interested because that's just the thing I can't know. I mean, you know, it's like I had this famous, it's like I had this conversation, I remember in law school, with a professor who was a partner at a plaintiff side law firm. So she would sue on behalf of people, in things like sexual harassment claims, you know, discrimination claims. And a lot of times the issues revolved around things like, you know, did someone say something? Did someone touch somebody? And I remember having this conversation with her. And she's a plaintiff's lawyer, right? And I'm a what you would call a true believer do-gooder. And I'm sitting there with her, and I'm saying, you know, like, do you ever think about what happens, like, between what actually happened in the situation? She's like, no, I can't. I can never know. Like, I'll never know what happened between my client and the person that they claimed touched them or said something inappropriate to them. I'll never know. The only two people who know, really, are those two people. I have to accept that as part of my work. All I can do, and what my job fundamentally is to tell a story and shed, you know, and give the jury, the decision maker, the fact finder, information that would lead them to the conclusion that is favorable to my client. But I can never really know what happened. It's just, it's impossible. And I've accepted that as part of my work. This isn't about the truth. This is about persuading a fact finder. And, you know, I had two reactions. One of them was, wow, she is a very good lawyer. She must be a very, very good lawyer. Two, she is zen as fuck. And three, I guess I can't do as much good as I thought I could. It was funny to learn that in the last semester of law school. but no, I mean, right, like, I can't really know what happened. And I mean, even talking with like friends of mine who I feel like are a little more like even handed with the situation, you know, even friends of mine who are upset about the situation or have experienced their own issues with assault, my friend basically saying, look, I can never really know. I can't really know. I mean, she says it's 100%, you know, certain that she did it. He's saying it's 100% that she didn't. You know, we have science that would say that, you know, she can't remember, you know, like and the science around it is like super murky and confusing to me. Like, you know, there's the argument of saying, well, we have to give a little bit of a wider berth to a victim of a sexual assault because their memory, because it's they're experiencing trauma. You know, some people would say, well, they're experiencing trauma, so I guess the memory is sharper. And then other people are saying, well, no, actually, someone's experiencing trauma, the memory is duller and more vague. I really don't friggin' know. So I'm not even really going to go there, though that aspect of science and the mind is very interesting. I might talk about that a little bit later if I have time, or it'll be on another episode. Stay tuned. The mind, I am very fascinated by it. But in any case, I can't really know. To paw it off to my professor, I can't really ever know really what happened. But I can see is how our country and how everything is reacting to it. I have lots of thoughts and feelings about that. And hopefully not just thoughts and feelings, but things I can share that, you know, I don't know, you may find interesting, to be honest, because it's not really about even what I think. I'm not really even interested in what I think, like, about the situation. I'm more interested in, like, my observations about everything else that's gone around. Anyways, enough talking about talking. Why don't I just get to the talking? So, yeah, it's weird. The Kavanaugh thing is like, it's weird because it's like a bunch of things. To me, this is my observation just from the outside. And I say this as someone who didn't listen to the hearings, but listened to a lot of the coverage of it and read all the newspapers. I read like the Financial Times in London because I'm fancy like that, the Wall Street Journal because I stole that from work, and the New York Times because I also stole that from work because I subscribe to the Washington Post. That's my hometown paper. Shout out to Jeff Bezos. Keep those warehouses hot, baby. And that's for all of you listening at home who follow labor law. And it's weird because it's like this weird it's like so multidimensional that it's confusing fundamentally. Like this, it's a situation that's designed to make no one happy except the Republicans who are about to confirm Kavanaugh. That's the only people that's going to make happy. Everyone else is going to make them sad. Because it's weird. It's like a sandwich. It's like a, it's technically, you know, when I started hearing about this, I heard about this from the perspective of it almost being like a trial, right? They brought in literally a prosecutor to ask Ford questions. But it, but then it's easy to forget that it's also a confirmation hearing. And it's also a political theater. And it's the Me Too movement. And it's Democrats versus Republicans. And most importantly, it's an election year. I try to emphasize to people, at least this was my thought, is, you know, when everyone gets upset about this, they need to realize that this debate isn't about Me Too. This isn't about, sexual misconduct. This is about jobs. It's about the senators keeping their jobs. That's what it's about. Like, you know, fundamentally, like everything, when I really like look at this, it's like, oh, it's all like political theater. And that doesn't mean to say that like real interests aren't at stake, but like they will be subsumed in a political theatrical production, financed by Congress. It's just, that's what this is. That's what it is. And yeah, I just, like it's fundamentally about like whether people get to keep their jobs, whether they get to. That's what a lot of the posturing is, and so it's weird because it's like it's hard because I think all those things matter. Like I think the confirmation hearing matters. I think political battles matter. I think Me Too. I mean, I definitely think that that matters and that should be is important. But it's almost like taking. How can I describe it? It's. You know, there's a phrase where people say it's like trying to get milk from the hardware store, like trying to get vindication for a victim of sexual assault in the middle of a confirmation hearing. It ain't going to happen. Like, it just isn't. Like, it's impossible, you know? It'd be like, I think it's akin to, like, trying to make your coworkers your friends. Like, you know, or trying to make your coworkers your family. That's like, they're not my family, right? Like, I'm not gonna get, like, the hugs. Encouragement and low grade, mild subliminal judgment that I will get from a family. I won't get that from a coworker. I'll get like performance evaluations and spitballs and terrible conversations about their thoughts about Game of Thrones. That's what I'm gonna get. I'm not gonna get, you know, all the beautiful things I get from my family that I already listed. It's not, you know, it's just going for the wrong thing. It's like, look, you know, if you want to be told. That you need to lose some weight, don't go to your coworkers, go to your family, okay? Go to your family. Your coworkers should not be pressuring you to get married. Your family absolutely should. And I'm speaking totally hypothetically, not about my life. Not about my life in the least. But anyways, yeah, it's just, it doesn't, like the Me Too movement is not going to get vindication from this process because that's not what this process was designed for. It's like, it's totally designed for a different purpose. It's like that. It's like Me Too going to a political confirmation hearing and expecting good results is like me. It's like me going to like Chipotle and ordering Sbarro ordering a freaking rocket ship. It's just it's not gonna happen. The process is incapable of producing this. Which is, like, that's the crazy thing about politics, right? Like, it's super important, but it can't do anything but serve itself. I was telling a friend of mine that I feel like what politics is going to do to Me Too. I mean, it's one thing. It's different if they're debating, like, a piece of legislation, right? Because in that case, it is like I am going to Congress for a piece of legislation about sexual harassment. So that is like going to Sbarro and ordering Sbarro, right? But like going to a confirmation hearing and asking for progress on Me Too is like it ain't gonna work. It ain't gonna happen. It's and because the political process, especially this close to an election to midterm elections in a frigging. You know, in like a crazy political time that is super, super polarized, The political process is incapable, I think, of taking anything and using it productively. It's always going to turn things into its own ends. It's like, I mean, I shopped a few analogies with a friend. I sort of said that it was like, I threw out a couple. She liked one more than the other, but that guns, like the way that we talk about this, like think about the way we talk about like Me Too, just with people, like sexual harassment with people. And then think about the way we talk about it in Congress, like in the context of this hearing, is to me akin to the way we like talk about school shootings when they happen. And then when we talk about like gun legislation, like there's such disconnected conversations. And I actually, and she didn't really like that analogy, my friend didn't, but I think this is an even better one, which is that it's like music. It's like you've got music, a social movement happens outside of institutions, right? That's what Me Too is, right? It's a free-floating idea. It's like Black Lives Matter, where it's just this free-floating movement. And that's really a lot of its strength, that like it's its own thing. With its own, you know, it can be whatever you want it to be. It's really just like a matter of what the participants think it should be. You sort of vote by showing up, and you just constantly keep voting every day by participating in the conversation. But it's totally happening outside of institutions. And society, like, we're fundamentally structured in a lot of cases by institutions and access to power in institutions and influence in institutions. So eventually, at some point, we want to take these movements and we want to bring them into institutions, but institutions generally absorb things and have them serve their own ends. You know, an example of this is, I think music is a great example, where, you know, you've got like, and think about like an artist like The Weeknd, right? Like The Weeknd, when he came out, like all of his stuff was about selling drugs in Toronto and having orgies and just doing a bunch of cocaine and smoking a bunch of weed and, you know, just... you know, scaring these good girls and sleeping with a ton of them. And then he literally went from like that to like releasing an album where he's wearing a cross on the cover of it. Like that's what the music industry, you know, like he went from being this wild person to like being in an institution, you know, and just singing love songs. Like, I don't really think he talks about like doing drugs or being a weirdo anymore. Like he's like very, you know what I mean? Like he's Walmart as fuck now. and I feel like the institution's got it. Like the music business will absorb him, but it will also shape him towards its ends. And I feel like that's the same thing you can say about this process. And I think that's fundamentally why people are frustrated. Because it ultimately can take a movement that's happening in the wild, a nascent movement, if you will, to put it in political science terms, and it will take it and it'll say, cool, like, you know, please, welcome, be a part of society, be a part of what's going on, but will absorb it towards its own purposes. And I feel like that's basically what's going on. So, and what that means is, well, Me Too becomes like a political shit. People's, you know, people, I mean, you know, my friend, I had this long conversation with this friend of mine. Just, you know, and she gave me her thoughts. It was just very open, really appreciated her thoughts about a lot of this stuff. You know, she pointed out that like people are dealing with so much, like, right? The idea that like the hearings opened up so much trauma for people. And how that didn't feel fair because essentially the political process opened up trauma for people, but didn't give them a solution. And I don't know. I mean, my feeling about that is that's not the purpose of the political process. Like it never does that. Like it never really respects people's emotions. It's more like, okay, your emotions and your passions are an input into this machine. And this machine operates with its own set of rules and its own incentives. And especially this, like I said, this close to an election, it really operates with its own incentives. They're very naked, very obvious. And so you're not really going, yes, it will open up wounds. And actually I have thoughts about maybe that's a good thing. I mean, it's opened up wounds for me. You just deal with it. And, you know, maybe you actually heal from those wounds, I guess, is what I'm saying. I don't know. Like, I think it's, really, like, you can't expect the political process will blow this thing up, and it's really sort of up to us as, like, as individuals and as Americans, maybe not just as individuals, but as a community, like, collectively put ourselves back together. And that's going to take time, but that's not really what the political process is about. Like, it's like we need to win elections now, right? And I think that that's what made the hearing between the people, it made, you know, between the people on the Senate Judiciary Committee, that's what made it so, like, angry between them, is the fact that we're this close to this political process. Also, just the fact that, like, you know, Democrats are pissed that Merrick Garland didn't get confirmed. And it was pretty shady that Merrick Garland didn't get confirmed. That was, like, pretty, pretty shitty. But I hope, you know, Antonin Scalia wouldn't want it any other way. Holler. So... Yeah. Oh, wait. No. Scalia was replaced by Gorsuch, I believe. Anyways, I forget who replaced who. Not really matter. But yeah. I mean, like, it's gonna be hard for, like, for the political process to actually give people peace. And I don't really think it's the purpose. I will say that, like, overall, like, one of the best analogies I heard, it was on Left, Right, and Center. I heard on KCRW, was it compared the hearings to a Rorschach test. Where basically, you know, and Rorschach's like an ink blot, and the idea is it's just an ink blot, and you ask people what they see in it to get insight into what's going on in their minds and how their perceptual systems work. Because basically, like, a Rorschach test is essentially a shorthand way of saying people see what they want to see. People pull out the things they want to pull out of it. And the reason I mentioned, like, those layers, like I mentioned earlier that there were all these layers, like, this is a confirmation hearing, this is a political battle, this is an election year, this is the Me Too movement, like... that it's all these things. It's about sexual harassment. No, it's about jobs. I mean, I say that stuff, like, as a joke, but I also say it as, like, yeah, because people can just look at the dimension that they want to play on, the dimension that makes them feel comfortable, and they have so many options. There's so many ways. There's so many perspectives to, like, have on this situation that it's just easy. You just choose the one that sort of serves you. And you see that, right? Like even, like, I mean, first of all, just in terms of what I heard on the radio and especially reading these goddamn newspapers, like, my God, like, everything was just what people wanted to see. And it was crazy. And yeah, I don't know. I just, it's like, weird and interesting. I mean, my main takeaway is it seems like, right, obviously he was a controversial nominee before this stuff even came up. I mean, you know, a lot of people didn't like him. He's like, I mean, he's Federalist Society as hell. And Lord knows I hate those guys. They're just super conservative, and they've come up with their own judicial philosophies that they cooked up basically on the back of the civil rights movement to basically say, oh, the intention of civil rights is actually to support all these existing power structures. The purpose of civil rights is simply to keep the status quo as it is. Maybe we can actually roll things back in some areas. But essentially, it's repurposed the civil rights movement and the Bill of Rights for, like, all of these purposes that are just bananas. And really, it's a strength of numbers thing where you have enough conservative bodies on the judiciary who believe this, and all of a sudden it's a valid idea. But there's no, I don't really know if there's any basis for it in jurisprudence, like, historically. Like, it feels like they just sort of made it up. I don't know. I mean, you could, I guess, make the argument that we made civil rights movement up, but that doesn't really feel like that's the case, because we had the Civil War, and then we had all these amendments, you know, which expanded federal powers in very specific ways in response to a civil war, which is, like, I mean, that's, like, a whole other constitutional debate, and I probably should get on Erwin Chemerinsky. I'm going to get him on the phone. He'll be my guest next week, for sure. I just keep reaching out to him, and he's nice enough to answer the phone and then hang up on me. I'll give that to Erwin. I'll holler. yeah, he's like, who, new phone, who dis? but basically, like, you know, the people who don't like him continue to dislike him, and they find new reasons to dislike him. The people who like him continue to like him. And anything that happens seems to go through that rubric. Like, there's a part of me that wants to be like, he's got a screwed up judicial temperament. Like, everyone friggin' says that. But I'm like, I mean, first of all, like, I'm not really quite sure that that's true. I have a couple thoughts on that. I mean, first of all, it's like, well, if he was angry, you'd be like, oh, he's an asshole. And if he was calm, I think the criticism would be, oh, he did it then because he's too calm and he's too collected. Right? Like, any way you cut it, I feel like the people who don't like Kavanaugh would have said whatever his response would have been on, what was that? The hearing was on Thursday? On Friday? I forget. But basically, like, any way you cut it, people would have been critical of him. Because if you fundamentally don't want him to be on the bench, you're going to, like, any reaction he has is going to feel bad. I don't know. I'm not really convinced. I mean, personally, I'm not really convinced by the temperament thing. I mean, I've heard stories. Like, I have a friend who's at the Department of Justice, and he's a federal prosecutor. And he tells me that, like, you know, he comes and sees a judge, and the judge is an asshole, and yells at him, and bullies him, you know, like, judicial temperament, you know what I mean? Like, that guy's an Article III judge. You know, like, there's a story, I mean, a story that I really like is a story about, like, Elena Kagan told the story, right? Justice Kagan, she told a story about, because she was a superstar, and she clerked for Thurgood Marshall. And she said that when her and Thurgood Marshall would get into debates about the law, right, sometimes, like, when Thurgood would disagree with her, like, and she was taking a more moderate approach, Thurgood would start yelling, point at the seal that he had on the wall of his office that was pointing into the Supreme Court. And he said, whose name is on that? So he would just like yell at his clerk and just like big time her. You know, like, so I don't know. I mean, this judicial temperament thing, it's just like, yeah, no, I'm pretty sure that judges behind the scenes are fucking assholes. Just like a lot of people are assholes. And like the idea that he's publicly was this way again feels like a political moment. It just feels like a play. Also, the other thing is, I would say is I'm not sure if Kavanaugh is that angry of a guy or if he was also just like putting on a show for Trump. That doesn't necessarily excuse his behavior, but it does make it hilarious. In my opinion, because that's also just like the idea that like Kavanaugh is like this mild mannered person who's controlled for the most part, but like. I mean, maybe he genuinely was angry, but there is also this sense that, you know, as a continuation of the idea of that this is political theater, is that, like, Kavanaugh is actually getting angry and crying and reading this story because he wants Trump to not pull his nomination. It's interesting because that's sort of in the background, and that's what no one is actually talking about. That maybe Kavanaugh just, like, flipped out because he was like, I'm losing. I need to have like a big fourth quarter surge, and he's paying for it. But like fundamentally, like the people he has to please, he doesn't need to please America. Like my theory is that I don't know. I mean, a guy like Kavanaugh, like if you're at that level as a lawyer, like you're hungry for the opportunity. I mean, Kavanaugh could have made a boatload of money somewhere else. He really wants to be a judge. He really wants to influence the political process. He really wants to disempower people. That's what he really, really wants. And so he'll do, like, anything he can to make that happen. Like, I'm pretty sure that, like, if Trump told him to show up if Trump was like, look, the only way you're being confirmed is if I put a dog collar on you and walk you into the hearing, I'm pretty sure Kavanaugh would have done it. He would have just been like, well, you know, can I wear my wingtips? Because I gotta look good. You know, can the leash be red? So the conservatives know that I'm that Republican. he would have woofed if it meant he could be elevated to the Supreme Court. That's just the vibe. That's just the vibe I get. So my feeling is he's playing a character in the same way that, like, remember when like Scaramucci was around? There were these videos that came out where Scaramucci was actually copying Trump's mannerisms very consciously. Like, you can find videos on YouTube where you can see that, like, Scaramucci in press conferences would do the exact same mannerisms that Trump would do. And it was just fucking hilarious. Because Scaramucci is smart. He just knows. He's like, look, I just have to please my boss. That's the only person I'm trying to please. If I please my boss, like, the world can, you know, call me a piece of crap. But if I'm pleasing my boss, he's going to love me. And fundamentally, until the Scaramucci thing leaked, Trump seemed to like him because he was emulating Trump. And I feel like it's the same thing. Kavanaugh is just... Kavanaugh lost, quote-unquote, lost his shit. But I really think it was just a calculated move on Kavanaugh's part. He's not stupid. He's totally in control of himself. Well, maybe not when he's, like, a young man. Again, not going to go into that. But yeah, no, I mean, like, at this point in time, no, he's totally in control of himself. My personal feeling is that Kavanaugh did all that to fire up Trump. Because there were rumors that Trump was going to pull his nomination, potentially. So, I can see it. Because Kavanaugh's sort of going for the gold, and also, like, he has a bunch of insiders. You don't think he has, like, tons of liaisons between him and the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee and Republicans in the Senate, period? Just the Republican, you know, whatever, the caucus, whatever you call it. Like, and basically they advised him, like, look, flip out. Trump will like it. It'll fire up Republicans. And sure enough, it worked. It freaking worked. The Republicans started just talking shit to the Democrats, like, right in the middle of the hearing. Like, it worked perfectly, you know? And then Kavanaugh apologizes afterwards. Like, I sort of feel like, this is crazy, but I feel like maybe it lacks a certain amount of integrity, but, you know, we all know that the court's a political process, and we definitely know that Trump is a demagogue. And, like, and I say that, like even if you like him, he's still a demagogue. And so people have to play to that. That's just the way it goes. Like, Kavanaugh's audience is in America. Just like how Scaramucci's audience was Trump, that's the only person he really cared about. He wanted to be the apple of Trump's eye. Which, an expression that still doesn't make any fucking sense to me. But Kavanaugh's audience is literally 51 senators and a wizened orange person. Like, that's it. He avoided the axe. I remember reading the New York Times. The New York Times, it was also just funny as an aside. I want to say that, like, each newspaper had a very different number of pieces on it. Like, the New York Times had probably, like, 15 pieces about this hearing, if not more. And then that doesn't even include the op-eds. Which I didn't read. But, like, the Wall Street Journal had, like, two news stories about it and probably like, 6 or 7 op-eds. Like, a lot of op-eds. And then the Financial Times, because it's, like, in the UK, had, like, one story on it. Admittedly, front page, you know, major news. But basically, otherwise, the FT was, like, F that. And it basically was, like, what you do inside your country is no business of mine. And yeah. So, you know. Repping it hard. But basically, the New York Times, like, in their coverage... by the way, one of my favorite things about the Financial Times is that they're on the location that the original Globe Theater was at, that, like, Shakespeare legit performed at. And obviously that thing is gone now. It's a little bit... The new Globe Theater is just down the Thames, at a new location. But to me, the fact that, like, there was a theater there... And then now there's, like, a financial journalism company. To me, it speaks to, basically, that's how gentrification works. like always. That's actually just gentrification, like, in a nutshell. Like well, we used to do Shakespeare theaters here. Now we report on derivatives and after-hours trading. The only thing that's missing to be a true gentrification story is there was no matcha green tea. Place right next to the Financial Times, at least that I could tell from the boat as I went by. That was an amazing trip to London. I think I've talked about it before. I'm going to talk about it again. I'm incorrigible, like a certain president of the United States. But yeah, no, it worked. Kavanaugh's faith was, Trump's faith in Kavanaugh was tested and restored. It's like a love story. They got back together at the end. It worked out. It's like La La Land, except it's all inside, what's her name's head? Emma Stone's head. But yeah, I feel like it would be a disservice to mock Kavanaugh for crying and harping and harp on his judicial temperament, because it ignores, like, what's really going on in the bigger picture. Like, if you just dump on Kavanaugh, you're sort of going for, like, personally, from my perspective, you're going for the easiest conclusion. Because there's a much more complicated thing to explore, which is I think the thing that's much, much more complicated to explore is that Kavanaugh was playing a game, and he's playing a game that's based and set up and arranged by Trump. And he's just got to play this game, and he feels comfortable playing this game. I think that that's the real story to me. You know, it's not really, I mean, you can have this sort of like indictment of Kavanaugh based on his performance, but like, I think it's far more interesting to just have an indictment of the entire political system. And I say that as someone who likes to stuff, sometimes see stuff burn, you know, I like to see stuff burn. I like to see stuff burn. It's like that scene with what's his name? The guy. I'm Batman's butler, and it's not quite a perfect accent, but what I'm trying to get at is I like the line in The Dark Knight Rises, where what's his name, you know, the butler, Alfred, basically says, like, oh, you know, like to see, like, that some men just want to see the world burn. And when I heard that line, I was like, I think I'm one of those dudes. I think I do just want to see the world burn. That seems fun. That seems cool. I'm down with that. But yeah, so that's, I mean, you know, in some ways that's actually what this podcast is actually about, I think. It's just about wanting to see the world burn. but not really, but sort of, but yeah, but no, but maybe. No. Of course I do. That's why it's called Don't Believe Jack, even. So now you know the story. Anyways, back to what we're talking about. Yeah, so like it's like this weird game, right? And people do have to put on a show for Trump, especially for Trump. They have to put on a show because, boy, I don't know a president who loves a show more. Lincoln got shot in the head at a theater. Trump loves a show even more than Lincoln does. That's dark. yeah, I don't. I mean, he loves a show. He loves a show. Maybe the way to say that is that the only person who loves a show more than Trump is Lincoln, because he was shot in the theater. But shout out to Abraham Lincoln. Do love him. You know, he's the GOAT. I think he's the GOAT. Yeah, it's hard to say who else is. I mean, talk about a more trying time. You know, I mean, I know Michael Jordan played a game with the flu, but I mean, Abraham Lincoln is the GOAT, hands down. And Trump is probably the GOAT, but in lowercase. God, that's a good acronym, GOAT. That is a great acronym, because it's also deeply ironic. Ugh, God, it's good. It's so good. GOAT's just GOAT's a great, great, I just like saying it, because it means the opposite. As an acronym, it means the opposite of its meaning. Okay, I just ruined that joke by dissecting it. But you know what? This is a great comparative literature class, and I hope you're enjoying it, students. I'm not being paid anything by the university, and actually security's going to come and escort me out in about 20 minutes. But in any case, yeah, he is the GOAT. It's just, he's legit. It's the truth. It's the truth, y'all. So, I don't know. Anyways, it's fun. I'm going to yawn. Even I'm getting bored. I'm really selling this hard. I'm even getting bored. Just start yawning. I'm gonna just do that. I think my voice is honest in a way that my mind is not. Oh my God, I'm like my face is like heating up with embarrassment. I'm burning myself. This is great. Self burn. But yeah, no. But like, it's just like even Lindsey Graham just like yelling at the Democrats. Like, it's like there's a part of me. It's like Lindsey used to hate. Lindsey Graham sounds like a very, very attractive woman, and a very, very conservative Southern man. Those are the only two people who can pull off that name, but both of them are blondes. so Yeah, like even Lindsey. I mean, this really is just like theater because like Lindsey Graham is yelling at Democrats. Remember, like when Lindsey Graham, like in the run up to like the Trump thing, like the Trump thing. I'm just gonna call it the Trump thing, not the Trump administration, the Trump victory. No, you know the Trump thing. But the Trump thing, and he's like a good old boy, right? Like Lindsey Graham is a good old boy. And so there's the argument that, like, he's becoming more cantankerous because he is, I don't know, because he's upset by the process. But, like, it really is political theater. I mean, not that Graham is seeking re-election right now, but the reality is, like, he's got to be close to Trump. Remember, like, Lindsey Graham used to fucking burn Trump? He went on The Daily Show and said Trump was crap and he didn't believe in him. Well, like... Friggin' now, Trump, like, now Lindsey Graham is, like, Trump's best boy. You know what I mean? He's gonna be on the wall of Hogwarts. That's the Hogwarts. Hogwarts. Excuse me. I mispronounced that on my podcast. But, yeah, I mean, he's just, and it's like, why is Lindsey Graham? Like, again, we have to look at, like, the bigger picture. Why is Lindsey Graham yelling at the Democrats? Because he's in South Carolina. He's the senator from South Carolina. And probably the thing that he's fundamentally worried about is a challenge from the right. And so he knows he has to get close to Trump because Trump overwhelmingly won South Carolina. South Carolinians love Trump. I think they love Trump more than they, I think they're the state that actually voted the highest for Trump. And Lindsey Graham has to respect that as part of being a senator. So I think part of the thing is he's got to get close to Trump because he carries one of the highest approval ratings for Trump, which is like, I mean, I just think as like a digression, that's like even interesting, right? Because it's like, if politicians are meant to represent like the will of the people, that like the people are very fickle. So does that mean politicians ought to be very fickle? Like clearly I have to say that, you know, like even if Lindsey Graham really does feel like this is just a game and he feels like the Democrats are being dishonest, I feel like the reason he would yell something like that across at a hearing is just to put on a show because he's the senator from South Carolina and he needs to keep his seat and he's up for election in 2020 and he's not untouchable. He's just not untouchable. And he knows that, and friggin' everyone on that panel knows that they're not untouchable and they're right near an election. And they're all just trying to play out the string on whatever games they have. I don't know. Like, I mean, there's a part of me, like, look, I'm like, well, whatever. Enough about me. But, like, you know, like, even me looking at, like, the Democrats, like, yeah, there's definitely, like, a game going on. So everyone's, you know, when I hear people, admittedly, when I talk with my friend, you know, even she's a liberal, you know, and she made the point of saying, like, well, everyone is playing political games. Like, everyone is playing political games. And I think that that's the truth. Like, you know, the idea that, like, Feinstein sat on, like, this accusation. She had this letter, and she just released it at this moment, I think was partially because, yeah, release this late in his confirmation hearing process. Don't release it early. Release it close to the vote because, you know, it can cause a lot of chaos. And then what did the Republicans do? They counter by saying, okay, well, we'll postpone this for a week, and we'll have an investigation. We're gonna postpone this a week. And I think fundamentally, it's like, is that really so they can have an FBI investigation, or is it so they can let some of the emotion of the testimony last week cool off before they actually have a vote, and try to keep working each other and hope America sort of like calms down? Which, I mean, you know, as far as I can see, America has calmed down since last Friday. It is a little more chill. And yeah, I mean, you know, like, so it's all just like political games. It's all like moving around each other and shifting. It's like boxing, you know, like I think it might be that like this UFC fight between what's his name? The Eastern European guy and friggin' Conor McGregor is probably the closest analogy to what's going on right now between the Democrats and the Republicans. And fundamentally, this isn't Me Too. This isn't Congress versus Me Too. This is Democrats versus Republicans. That's the story. to me, as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, how can we say that this process isn't political? It literally has to be political. It's on the friggin' hill. Like, you know, but I don't think it's the last word on, and this is the main thing I wanted to say, because I know a lot of people were, like, really sad about it or feel like our country's so broken or not healed. And I'm like, dude, it's been, people were upset, like, on Saturday about it or on Monday about it. I'm like, it's been 3 days. Like, healing takes time, and, you know, for our society to process these things takes time. And I think it's great. Like, I said up top that I think that it's a misuse of the, you know, like, the idea is, I didn't say that the Me Too aspect of this was a misuse of the political process. I just said that it was happening in a process that was not designed to really deal with things like this. It just really wasn't. But it doesn't mean that it's not good, and it doesn't mean that, like, that trying to impose Me Too on this, or sexual harassment, or concerns about women in society and how they're treated, like, I don't necessarily think that's a misuse. Like, I just think that you're bound to lose when you bring it to a forum like this. But I think you can lose and still win, you know? Like, I mean, I think, like, Republicans know they have to tread carefully around these issues. Like, and it's only been a week. It's been a week. Like, society moves so glacially slow. But just the idea that we are all having a conversation about this in a super public way in the political process, maybe that's the victory. I don't know. Like when the Weinstein stuff went down, you just read it in newspapers and people talked about it as talking heads. But, like, the political system never really had to deal with it. And, yes, the political system uses it towards its own end. But, you know, that's part of the point. You know, like, even going back to what I said earlier, like, The Weeknd makes great music still. You know, he's just part of the music industry now. Still makes great music. Still enjoy it. Still dance to it. My last girlfriend, you know, we were in the car and we were listening to sing falsetto and holding hands. And it was great. You know, it was still good, even when it was bad. And that's how I feel like things are now. You know? I forget. What was the Weeknd song that I heard? We were listening to. It was, you know, the one off his most recent album. I can feel it coming. Or something like that. I don't know. I think that's... I forget how the lyrics go. Now I'm going to... God, I want to look this up. Yeah. The Weeknd's last single was just great. You know? Even though it had, like, a goofy cross on it. And it wasn't, you know... talking about Weeknd... Last... I can feel it coming. I forget how it goes. Let's see. Weeknd. Yeah, Starboy. There's a big ass cross on it. I mean, come on. Come on now. I'm a motherfucking Starboy. I feel it coming. Yeah, that song is great. It's a monster single. And it's beautiful. It's a smash. You know? And I don't care the fact that, like, it's got, you know, like, it, that it, that it, it, you know, it's like corporate music. It's just, you know, it's nice. They've repurposed a wild thing to a purpose, and we're all enjoying it. And I think, ultimately, we'll all be really, like, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's just easy for me to say, but, like, I think we'll be thankful that all this happened. Because, you know, like, it's going to motivate. It's like what I said to someone. Like, look at all the women who are, because of Trump, look at all the women who are running for office. Like, that's great, you know, like, women being more involved in politics or taking more agency or, you know, like, yes, when I think everything is said and done, I think the biggest success of Black Lives Matter is not going to be around police shootings. It's going to be around people, like progressive people running to be district attorney in cities, especially African Americans running to be district attorney. I think that's going to be, like, a huge, that's the lasting impact. Ultimately, you know, to go back to the analogy I was saying earlier, like, things have to be swallowed by, at a certain point, even wild things have to move into institutions. So, like, society can change because it's institutions fundamentally that dictate how society works. So, I don't know. This is my feeling. I feel it coming. Yes, that's what I feel. That's what I feel. I feel like change is a coming, right? I mean, like, look, even the story of, like Feinstein, even, she decided to run for Senate in response to the Anita Hill hearings. And I want to say that, you know, this is, like, yeah, stuff comes back around, you know? Look, like, we got all the same TV shows on the air. You know, Roseanne, Will and Grace, Murphy Brown, you know, the Clarence Thomas hearings. We're getting everything back and better this time with higher ratings and a lot of nostalgia. And, you know, I think things will get better. This is, I don't know. That's just my take. It's just things will get better. And, you know, like, and there's not going to be a civil war. I'm really convinced of that now, especially reading all these papers and hearing all this discussion. We're not going to have a civil war because this isn't about economics. That's fundamentally the real reason why we won't have a war. If this was about economics, oh, we'd be killing each other already. I'd have a machete through someone's chest. You know, I'd be hacking off heads. Or I'd be dead. I don't know. But this, thankfully, all of this conflict in our society is not about economics. It's about, like, beliefs. It's about, like, abortions. It's about, I don't know, it's about... it's about, you know, like, police shooting on our black motorists. But that's, none of that is about economics. So, like, we won't actually have a war. I think wars happen because of economics. The more and more I've thought about it, I don't know. It's just me. Maybe I'll talk about that more sometime. But, yeah, I don't know. I think these issues don't threaten the American way of life. Not really. So we'll just have to, it'll just motivate change. But it won't destroy things. Because we actually don't talk about the things that could actually destroy the American way of life, like trade wars, or, you know, all of our IP being taken, or I don't know, like we don't talk about, like, the South Pacific Sea or something, and we don't talk about things that are actually existential threats, because I don't know, it's in the same way that no one talks about death, like you know, we talk about, like, all the things but death. And it's like, oh, but death, that's the worst. It's like, yeah, that's why we don't talk about it. Shut up. Why do you want to bring up death, dummy? So I feel like all these things are, we talk about them, and they're solvable. You know, they're not existential threats. So I think good things can come out of all of this stuff. I think trauma lays you low in the short term, but in the long run, it really helps. And I think it does help motivate the political candidates of tomorrow. You know, like, I think we're going to see more women in politics. I think we're going to see Republican women scrutinizing things. And actually, to me, that's actually the most interesting block. Those 53% of white women who voted for Trump, like, they're an interesting block. It's interesting to see, are they going to move or are they going to stay the same? That's what I'm interested in knowing, really. I mean, you know, based on that New York Times story, the sense is that these conservative women are perfectly comfortable with the way things are. There was one of the stories that I read that was super interesting was about, you know, being at a viewing event where there are a bunch of women from Maine who were all white, go figure, you know, because Maine is one of the swing states. Susan Collins is a senator from Maine, and she's a Republican. And the question is, she's an important vote about... what's his name? But she's also, like, in a state where if she votes against Kavanaugh, there could be potentially repercussions, not only just from Republican men, but Republican women. Because one of the things I noticed was that in the story, the author of the story, and I don't know if this was just, like, the journalist trying to push things in the direction that the journalist wanted to look at things from, but the journalist made a point to mention whether people were survivors of sexual assault or rape, and also whether they were pro-life or pro-choice, and pro-choice or anti-abortion, you could say. And again, semantics. and one of our sponsors, Semantic. Semantics. That all sounds the same. Symantec, if you need security for your computer from the early 2000s, consider Symantec, because no one uses Symantec anymore. That's why we're advertising. That's why they're advertising on the show. They wanted me to tell you all that. That was actually all part of the copy. But basically, like, it's a win it doesn't look like the Republican women are budging. It looks actually, I mean, if anything, I thought it was interesting were the quotes from Republican women where they basically said things like, look, even if Kavanaugh, like, they either said, I don't believe Kavanaugh did it, or they'd say it was murky, or they'd say, well, he did it, but it was a long time ago. And in some cases, these were women who themselves have been victims of sexual assault. So, like, they're, you know, I mean, my point is, if there's a woman out there who's a victim of sexual assault, and she's like, yeah, he did do this, but, you know, it was a long time ago, and he's really changed his life now. Like, if those women are willing to say that, then I don't know. I mean, at least on that side of the ball, shit ain't gonna change, bruh. Not really. I mean, these are older women, you know, 60s, 70s. So maybe younger Republican women feel different, but my sense is that Republican women don't feel different. They are feeling fine with this.